debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news. Hurricane Irma is still rolling along in the direction of Florida. Some very big concerns there. President Modi in India getting in a little trouble. Some interesting stuff in the Financial Times today about the state of our economy. We're going to talk about Representative Rogers and how he's working to destroy satellites that tell us weather information. But in the midst of all this, Richard McGregor is with us. He's a journalist and former Beijing bureau chief with the Financial Times. He's the author of the new book, Asia's Reckoning, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century. You can tweet him at McGregor, M-C, G-R-E-G-O-R, Richard. And Richard McGregor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So your book, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century, some fascinating stuff here. What, you know, you talk in particular about the history wars. What are the history wars?
Well, I think anybody living in America should be familiar with history wars. Look what happened in Charlottesville recently. It takes a long time to sort of cleanse politics of history. Sometimes it never leaves. And East Asia's got their own big history wars, and that's really about Japan's invasion of China in the 30s, the war in the 40s, whether Japan apologized, whether they were sincere, whether China actually doesn't care if they apologize but just uses history as leverage in politics. And it's something which has permeated their relationship for, 70 years. And it's very consequential, right? These are the second and third biggest economies in the world. In 10 years, China will probably be the biggest. And the whole global economy goes, runs through these countries. And their inability to sort of get to a sort of a peaceful place on history makes it a very dangerous relationship.
There's a theory of history that war comes about, sometimes revolution, but typically just war, when one regionally dominant power loses the ability to assert that dominance and is replaced by another regional power, or a worldwide power for that matter. There are arguments that this is what informed both World War I and World War II and others, going way back in history. Do you subscribe to that notion, and do you see that kind of dynamic at play here? And if so, is it the U.S. Economically dominating Southeast Asia or Asia, or is it Japan post-World War II?
This theory's got a lot of play recently. It's about, the inevitability of a rising superpower falling into conflict with the established superpower, and that's the U.S. and China.
Right.
The so-called Thucydides trap, if I
pronounce that correctly. Yes, Thucydides, yes. Thank you.
I got a kind of slightly different take on that. I think the dangers, there is that danger, obviously. The U.S. and China are on a collision course. That's the bad news. The good news is that they know that and they try to manage it. But there's another thing that Greek writer came up with, and that's about it's dangerous to build an empire. It's even more dangerous to let it go. And I reckon that slightly describes better U.S. dilemma in Asia, because the U.S. is a kind of imperial power in East Asia. It has troops in Japan and South Korea 70 years after the war was won. But if they left, there would be a vacuum, potentially chaotic. It's why Japan and South Korea don't want the U.S. to leave, because they don't trust the country that would fill that vacuum, China. So, and I kind of think we're at a turning point now, because, you know, China wants to be the dominant power in Asia, and their sort of sentiment is, you know, thank you, America, you can go home now.
Right. And you know, you open the book with a fascinating analysis of how frustrated President Obama was with President Hu, and how pleased, apparently, he was with President Xi, in that Hu was, the previous Chinese president, was relatively impenetrable. He never shared what he was thinking and whatnot. Xi is much more proactive and like that. To what extent is Chinese politics and our interaction with Chinese, and the world's interaction with Chinese politics, personality dependent versus, you know, five-year plan, Communist Party has decided this, that, or the other thing dependent?
You know, it's a very good question, because Hu Jintao, who was the previous Chinese leader, was a very sort of bland individual, kind of charisma-free zone, if you like. Nobody could really get anything out of him other than largely scripted comments. Xi Jinping is a very different person, decisive, outspoken, quite aggressive. He's a risk-taker as well. And I think, so the personalities do matter. But I think the objective situation matters as well. You know, China was not so powerful 10, 12 years ago, 15 years ago when Hu Jintao took over. When Xi Jinping took over, he was in charge of a much more powerful country, so he had much more room to move. And I think Chinese aims and policies have kind of been pretty consistent, you know, and that now they've really got the capabilities, military capabilities, economic leverage to get what they want. So, you know, I think that's probably the bigger trend.
Yeah. There's a narrative that I know two people in the White House have been sharing with the president at some length, because I know them, that basically the United States climbed to industrial and international preeminence by copying the Tudor plan that had been put into place in England in the 14th or 15th century, which was, you know, basically a mercantilist plan that the Brits stole from the Dutch, and that they, you know, reinvented from the ancient Greeks and Romans, and that China has just kind of beat us at our own game. That China, starting, you know, 30, 40 years ago, decided to go in this mercantilist direction, you know, protecting their own economy and exploiting the availability of other people's economies. And that the only way to fight mercantilism is by doubling down on mercantilism, and, you know, and that's the, you know, the border adjusted trade, or, you know, the border adjustment taxes and tariffs and things like this. To what extent do you think that kind of thinking actually pervades, you know, the thinking with the U.S., China, Japan, and what do you think of it?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, there's no doubt that all countries at different times have been protectionist, and there's no doubt that in some cases they've been big winners from that. I mean, I'll tell you, South Korea and Japan were much more protectionist than China, than China was. China's kind of getting protectionist now. China needed to open up quickly when they decided to have a more market-based economy. They needed to open up quickly, but now that they've sort of caught up, they're sort of thinking, okay, well, you know, they are becoming more protectionist. I mean, it's a little bit true that, you know, China is doing just what the U.S. did to the U.K. in the 19th century, but it's a bit different in this respect. You know, modern economies the ability to steal, the value of stealing technology, the ability to sort of spread that technology, replicate it, benefit from it, I think is vastly greater these days than it was in the 19th century. And therefore, the act of theft is much more damaging these days. And I think the U.S. has got a very fair beef with China in stealing IP and protecting its own markets and tech companies and the like. You know, it's the sort of thing I think Trump should be focused on rather than steal.
Yes.
I would hope it would go like that rather than doubling down on mercantilism, because that I think that would be bad for everybody else.
Yeah. It's a very interesting time we live in, and I wish we had more time for this. I'd love to get into the North Korea thing, but I know you have to go at 15 after. It's a brilliant book, Asia's Reckoning, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century, the author Richard McGregor, and available from, you know, all your typical book sources. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Great talking to you. And you can tweet him at McGregor Richard. We'll be back. Welcome back. All the information yesterday and the day before, Donald Trump wanting to hook up with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. He's liking the Democrats. The Republicans are freaking out. I haven't seen any reports so far. Maybe you have. If you have, let me know. I mean, it's possible there's a news site that I missed this morning. I only read about 15 or 20 of them every morning. As part of my show prep here, but I haven't seen any reports about what Trump and Ryan talked about at dinner last night, or if Ryan stalked out of the White House, or, you know, if they were seen hugging each other or yelling at each other. I have no idea. But, you know, we've talked on this program at some length about the rise of authoritarianism around the world, and it's one of the things that most concerned me about the election of Donald Trump as president. Is that his tendencies are clearly authoritarian. You know, the idea of I'm the big guy, I'm the big cheese here, that kind of stuff. And authoritarianism seems to be on the rise around the world. You see an authoritarian government in the Philippines with Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte, and he's just explicitly killing people for using drugs and things like that. I mean, as one of many things, it's going after his political enemies in ways that are clearly authoritarian. Now it's happening in India. Excuse me. Narendra Modi, the president of India, who, when he was mayor of a provincial mayor or the equivalent of a county commissioner or something like that, you know, some part of India, actually, there were major riots where the Hindus murdered a bunch of the Muslims in this town. And Modi was somehow, and, you know, there's still a debate, directly, indirectly involved in all that. And that was kind of his political launching pad. That was for Modi the equivalent of Donald Trump standing up, you know, at Trump Tower and saying Mexicans are rapists and killers. And now you've got this woman, Guri Lankesh, who is a reporter in India. She lives in Bengaluru. And Tuesday, she walked out of her home and was shot in the head. And a bunch of Modi supporters are now tweeting and Facebooking and whatnot how happy they are that this journalist who had been calling out Hindu nationalism is dead. And Modi, as of the time that this article by Michael Safi was published in The Guardian, which was, I think, around 3 hours ago, Modi had not yet said anything about that, had not spoken out in defense of journalism or this particular journalist or reporters in general. And, so everybody's waiting to see, you know, what's the deal here. Meanwhile, the Financial Times, if you subscribe to it, as I do, and no, they don't pay me to say this. It's just, it's nice to have a newspaper that actually, doesn't seem to have a huge political axe to grind. Let's call it what it is. You know, the Financial Times is rich people reading about rich people learning about the economy. It's, you know, but for somebody who's an economy junkie, I find it fascinating. And this from their weekly summary that they send out, it's called the FT News Mine, some quotes, and it's basically kind of the best of the week, right? But here's a couple of them. Goldman Sachs is not the only bank struggling with its commodities business. The world's top 12 investment banks have just recorded their lowest half-yearly revenues in the area since 2006. So commodities are not doing well. Commodities would be, you know, copper, steel, gold, silver, iron, zinc, wheat, pork bellies, whatever. And the thing you need to know about commodities is that they are an early warning signal about the state of the economy. If food processors expect strong demand, they order extra pork bellies, right, to turn into, jerky sticks or whatever. I don't know if it's pork bellies or, you know, cows or whatever. I don't know what they make jerky out of. But you know what I'm talking about. If developers, housing people who build houses, expect strong demand is coming down the road, they buy more lumber. If car manufacturers expect more cars to be bought, they buy more steel. And in the course of buying these intermediate products, they're not the raw material itself. The raw material is the iron ore, right? The raw material is the field filled with corn. They're not the raw material, but they're the intermediate material. And when you see intermediate materials like that dropping in value, or the raw materials that produce them dropping in value, it typically means that at the wholesale level of the marketplace, the market is expecting the economy is going to go down. And in fact, FT points out this article titled "Decline in Investment Banks' Revenues from Commodities," that, quote, the world's top 12 investment banks have just recorded their lowest half-yearly revenues since 2006. I mentioned that. And then it goes on to say 41% lower than the first half of last year, a 41% drop. This is a significant signal, in my opinion. They also note, this is a decline in U.S. factory orders from a September 5th article in the Financial Times. U.S. factory orders in July fell by the most in nearly 3 years, signaling a speed bump for the manufacturing sector. Factory orders slid 3.3% in July. So, you know, this is not yet GDP. This is not yet the actual economy out there, the public economy. This is now just, you know, the stuff in the pipeline, right? The goods, basically, in the pipeline. But when they start to collapse, look out. Now, we don't know what impact Harvey and Irma are going to have on all this, because they're going to create mind-boggling, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of demand. So we'll see. The flip side of the demand that these hurricanes are creating by wiping things out is they're also wiping out people's ability to make a living still leverage their own money. Fantasy football fans, the wait is nearly over. Football is back, which means FanDuel is back. FanDuel is fantasy football for everyday fans. They have new contests starting every week, so there's no busted seasons. FanDuel has something for everyone. Lots of contests to choose from, starting at just $1. Just pick a contest, choose your team, and watch your score in real time. Hey, would you like to have Colin Kaepernick on your team? He's on mine. There's a lot of ways to put together and personalize your team, and boy, the games just get better and better. Over 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Sign up today. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use my code TOM, T-H-O-M. New users get free entry into the NFL Sunday Million with over $1 million in cash prizes when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. Just visit FanDuel.com and sign up with promo code TOM, T-H-O-M. That's FanDuel, F-A-N-D-U-E-L.com, promo code TOM. Void where prohibited. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. This is something that doesn't look particularly good. Equifax, one of the three big credit rating agencies, was hit by hackers apparently back on July 29th. And they announced this on September 7th, which, if my math is right, is 5 weeks later. And however, the week after the hack, on August 1st and 2nd, or a few days after the hack, according to reporting over by Luke Barnes over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, the headline is "Wealthy Executives Sold Off Equifax Stock Prior to Data Breach Revelation." Credit monitoring firm Equifax was left reeling this week after news that emerged that three senior executives had sold nearly $2 million in stock just days before the company discovered a cyber attack that had exposed the sensitive information of 143 million Americans. They discovered the data breach on July 29. They announced it 5 weeks later on September 7. However, on August 1 and 2, executives John Gamble, Joseph Lundgren, and Rodolfo Plotter earned a combined $1,780,000 by selling off stock, which the SEC was not. These are not pre-planned stock sales. And in addition to this, according to Bloomberg News, which first broke the story, Chief Financial Officer John Gamble made $946,000. U.S. Information Solutions President Joseph Lundgren made $584,000. And Consumer Information Solutions President Rodolfo Plotter earned $250,000. They're all saying, hey, you know, it was just a small sale. We're actually worth many, 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 many million. Yeah, so I make $1 million. So what? Doesn't matter. I'm so rich. It doesn't matter. That's the argument that they're making, right? I'm not sure anybody's buying it, but that's the argument that they're making. Anyhow, Linda in Norco, California. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. This is actually for Cliff and perhaps the woman that called a couple of days ago and was so discouraged. As I age here, I've been looking into quantum physics, and scientists are now beginning to realize we live in a conscious universe.
Yes.
And of course, any conscious system is built on feedback loops. So according to the Bible, actually, the soul that leaves the body at death is actually who we are. We are not these bodies. We are spiritual. We are souls, which means we're part of God. So it kind of cracked me up. Cliff was saying, how could God do this with the hurricanes? And I thought, we're part of God. We're living in chaos right now. What is a hurricane? It's chaos. So the weather is reflecting us, basically.
Well, in a way, I mean, technically, scientifically, what a hurricane is the transfer of heat energy from the ocean to the air. And because water is so much more dense than air is, a small amount of water can hold an enormous amount of heat, millions of calories or BTUs of heat that would influence a huge area of air, and which is why you can have the same heated ocean fuel three hurricanes in a row, which is what's going on right now. But yeah, I agree with you, Linda. There's Dean Radden wrote a brilliant book called Entangled Minds. Fred Alan Wolf, the physicist, wrote a brilliant book about how the universe is alive and conscious, the entire universe, and we're part of it. I love that theory, the idea that, you know, we're basically like radio receivers in a way. You know, the you turn on the radio and it's not that Madonna is there in your radio. You know, she's just singing through it. The signal is coming through. So the radio is a passive device, essentially, that's just tapping into the radio waves that are constantly all around us. And if you believe that the universe is, you know, if you take Einstein's equation that matter is made up of energy, and in fact, it's quantifiable, the amount of energy used to make a particular amount of matter, whether it's, say, this paper cup in my hand or whatever, the amount of energy that was used to make the matter in this paper cup and the coffee in it is equal to the mass of the cup times the speed of light squared, E equals mc squared. And so that means that everything is ultimately made out of energy, and we can quantify how much energy became matter in the creation, essentially. And so if everything is made out of energy, and energy is what consciousness is, you can build a strong argument that everything is made out of consciousness. In other words, everything is God. What do you think about that, Linda?
Deepak Chopra and Menzies Kafatos make in You Are the Universe.
Yes.
It's a wonderful book also.
Yeah, I agree.
So I just wanted people to be encouraged. We're going through, I believe, the spiritual evolution right now. And as horrible as the man in the White House is, look what has happened, how he has brought us together.
Yes.
And that is a spiritual gift. That is our next step on spiritual evolution.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. And I think that this is an opportunity for us to reconnect with each other, to reconnect with the core ideas of our country, both at the founding and contemporarily. It's you know, it's kind of a Mercury retrograde opportunity, a go inside opportunity. Linda, for people who may not have caught Cliff's call, Cliff had called earlier and said, how do you reconcile any belief in God with the idea that, okay, God saved this person, but killed that person in the storm? I mean, you know, really? And I said, I think that we diminish God when we anthropomorphize God or gods or goddess or whatever, that it's, you know, that's making God as small as we are. And I think that we need to just, you know, think of it as this incredibly huge thing. But anyway, Linda, I need to move along, but thank you for the call. Well said. William in Arizona. And William, I don't know how to pronounce that town. Can you say it for me, please?
Hold on a second.
Sure. It looks like Luca Chuck. Say it again.
Could you hear me?
Yeah. How do you say it?
Can you put me back in the queue?
Yeah. No, you're on the air. You're live on the air. How do you say your name and your town?
I'm in Sunrise Beach, Missouri. I travel. I deliver fifth wheelers and trailers around the country.
Ah. Okay. Okay. Great. So what's up, William?
But kudos to you about your past exposure to religion and stuff, but understanding that there's a connectedness of particles or subatomic or whatever. There's got to be something like that. I read things on it.
Look up Google quantum entanglement sometime. It'll blow your mind.
Where they can separate things and they react 20 miles away and all
yeah.
that kind of stuff.
Or 20 million miles away instantaneously.
The other thing is the Republicans, this is another case study they can't govern.
Yes.
And this is what my theory of Donald Trump was. If he ran as a Republican, he's given him first shot. He may be leaning towards Democrats now and saying to Republicans, you've had your chance. You've done nothing with health care. You've had 8 years. All you want is a tax break. All the deal, which she probably doesn't mind. But she may be saying enough with you guys.
Yeah. We'll find out, William. I'm not like one of these people. Like yesterday, I was saying, hey, you know, here's an opportunity and this is great and the Democrats should take this and use it. And I still believe that and I still agree with myself from yesterday. But, you know, at the same time, I don't think that any of us should think that Donald Trump is, you know, making large, sweeping, strategic thinking, you know, OK, I gave the Republicans 7 months and they screwed up this one and this one and this one and this one. So to hell with them. I'm going to go with the Democrats now. I don't think that he thinks that way. I think that he thinks, you know, what's happening today and what will make me happy and what won't. I think that he's much more operating in the universe of a child than an adult, frankly. But that said, I also think that the way that the Republicans have basically tried to manipulate him, I mean, they've been treating him as if they just, you know, there was this kind of joke during the election period. And I don't recall if it was Paul Ryan or somebody else who said it. Might have been Lindsey Graham. But whoever said it, you know, would you like to have Donald Trump as a president? And the answer was, you know, where's the effect of, well, as long as he can hold a signing pen, I don't care. Because, you know, the Republicans in Congress are going to pass the legislation. And he, as president, just has to sign it. I think that he's figured out that that's what they thought of him, that he was just the useful idiot. And he's reacting to it. So we'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. William, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Scott in Alameda, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm calling about the Equifax security breach.
Yeah.
143 million Americans' private information. It's like the Alibaba's cave for hackers. It's a credit card number. It's everybody can understand the seriousness of this. I called the Financial Services Committee members this morning. I tried starting with the chairman, Hanserling, and they hung up on me. I was very polite, and they hung up on me.
Really?
So I switched to the Democrats. I called Maxine Waters, other members. I would urge everyone to call the Financial Services Committee to get them to have hearings, to get Equifax executives in public testimony, explain exactly what happened, why it was 5 weeks, took them 5 weeks to come public with this. And that 5 weeks, hackers could have been doing extensive damage to millions of Americans. Also, I would urge that the callers demand that Equifax be the initiator of the service, rather than you having to go back to them. They're asking, Equifax is asking for the first six digits of your Social Security number in order to get free credit monitoring from them. So it's like if you were an armed robbery victim, you go back to the armed robber and say, can I see the gun again?
Right.
I mean, it's outrageous. So well, I would urge them to demand that Equifax, because Equifax already has your information.
Right.
They need to be the initiators of the service back to the consumer, not the other way around.
Yeah, I completely agree, Scott. And this lack of security that they had, and now these questions about their executives getting rich off this, is because their stock went down 5%, once the announcement was made. So everybody bailed out on their stock options and whatnot, and sold them off, put the money in the bank, and then it all stinks to high heaven. I agree with you. And I think that the Financial Services Committee, in both the House and the Senate, there's an equivalent of that in the Senate, should be investigating this. And Equifax and frankly, all the other credit agencies should at the very least come in and say, OK, here's the state of the art of our security measures. This is what we're doing. And then, we need to find out, do we have protections as consumers? Scott, thanks for the call. Well said. Oh, and Rush Limbaugh, who on Monday was saying, that Hurricane Irma, it's a hoax, right? It's liberals. He's evacuating. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And on the line with us, super pleased to have with us, Congressman Keith Ellison. He is the...
Brother Tom.
Congressman, it's great having you with us.
You bet it, man.
Ellison.house.gov is your website. At Keith Ellison, of course, is the Twitter account. And you said you are happy to take phone calls. We'll get some of those for you in just a minute. And you're with us for the half hour, right?
Well, I could probably hang out later than that. I know I have to probably I can go till about 1:40.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, just let me know. We've got a hard break at the bottom of the hour from 1:28 until 1:33, where that is dedicated, state local stations go to local news and advertisements and things. But other than that, we can work around pretty much anything. So what's on your mind? What's going on in Congress? What's going on in the Democratic Party that you want to tell people about?
Well, the first thing I want to mention, everybody, is that, look, with all of the horror around the hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, and the fires out west, and then the DACA fail and an attack that Trump just launched. Don't forget about Charlottesville. Don't forget about what he did to transgender soldiers, and don't forget about our pile. All these things are still there, and certainly don't forget about the Emoluments Clause violation. Don't forget that he's, the nepotism. All these things are still ongoing. And it has occurred to me, Tom, that the flood of scandal and attack and insult and outrage is just coming so furiously that people forget about the last horrible thing that he did. And so if he does anything slightly less horrible, then all of a sudden we're thinking, oh, he's getting better. He's not getting better. Everything he does is designed to promote a certain philosophy which says that poor people have too much, rich people have too little, that you have to be a certain racial, religious identity in order to be okay in his mind. And America only can accommodate certain people and not everyone. And he does not accept the idea of liberty and justice for all. So that's the thing on my mind first, that we should not let ourselves get stuck on by Trump simply because he has said he's willing to revisit DACA in 6 months. None of that. No, this is the same guy we've always seen, and we should add up his attacks and not forget about them. Mm-hmm. So that's that. DACA is certainly a front center thing in my mind. And it strikes me too, Tom, that, when you think about DACA, 800,000 people, here, these are people who grew up here. This is their country. They are Americans. They may not have the paperwork they need, but they are Americans in every way it needs to be one. They contribute to our society, make it better every single day. And I just, think that it's important for us to consider what it means to be an undocumented person in the United States. First of all, nobody comes to be in the United States just because, why not? Leave your home, your family, your language, your culture to come up here to be what? Discriminated against? No, people do it because, in my opinion, our U.S. policies around trade and other things to contribute to people's need to leave. Employers up here want to attract undocumented labor so that they can pay them less and they can have fewer rights. When you think about the undocumented people, these are folks who pay into Social Security, but they don't get it. They pay, if they pay rent, they pay property taxes, but they often are excluded from many of the public service benefits that go along with it. I mean, these folks, and then they have to live in fear. So I think it's important to understand that, you know, an undocumented worker is probably a highly exploited worker. So it is in the interest of all working people to give everyone a status. That way we can make sure that there's real justice for everybody. And that's kind of what you asked me, what's in my brain?
Yeah,
there's a lot more, but that's enough for now.
That's pretty solid stuff. Other thing before we pick up phone calls, I heard that you have a podcast. Like everybody's doing it. We started a podcast a couple of weeks ago. We call it the Hartman Report. Yeah, well, it's kind of best of this show. It's free. It's over on iTunes. Tell me about your podcast.
Well, my podcast is called We the Podcast. We the Podcast. We've been going for like 2 years now, and
wow.
The reason that we did it, Tom, is because I looked on regular network news. And you don't find economic news about regular people. When you ever find a TV broadcast show talking about, in the mainstream, talking about payday lending, talking about the diaper need, talking about the need to increase the minimum wage to $15, or talking about, even franchisees and how they often get mistreated by the franchisor and talking about monopoly and how market concentration is really hurting this economy. So basically, We the Podcast is all about how people outside the billionaire class experience this economy.
That is.
And you can go on iTunes and check us out, We the Podcast.
That's great. And that's, you're a young whippersnapper here, but I'm an old fart. And I remember, and maybe you're old enough to remember, I don't know, but I growing up in Lansing, Michigan, there were two statewide newspapers in Michigan, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. And one, and I forget which, but one was the labor paper and the other was the business paper. One had a business section, the other had a labor section. And, my dad worked in a tool and die shop, was very active with the union. We'd get the paper that had the labor section. And literally every day, there was 5, 6, 8 pages of labor news.
Right.
I think it's been basically since the 80s, since the Reagan era, that the newspapers have dumped all these labor pages, probably because they destroyed all the unions. But I think it's just super that you're filling that need, as it were, with a podcast.
Well, yeah, and so we like to talk about, the Nissan strike, the organizing drive here. We want people to know that, it's kind of a old saw now that, the labor movement is shrinking. No, let me tell you, man, there's a lot of fight in the labor movement, man. They're swinging every day. And so, we talk about what's going on. We had Lee Saunders on of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees on. That's the podcast. It's the most recent one. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about how it was AFSCME that stood behind the sanitation workers in 1968 when Martin Luther King marching with them was shot down and killed.
Yep.
But it was AFSCME. And I think a lot of people need to remember that, when Martin Luther King gave his great speech, the I Have a Dream speech, it was the UAW and other unions that helped bankroll that march. And it was unions that were there when he lost him. But, they won the strike anyway. Martin Luther King was prophetic on the importance of labor and unions and the dignity of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're gonna hit a real brief break here, and we'll be back in just a second with Keith Ellison taking calls from our listeners. Congressman Keith Ellison, the deputy chair of the DNC, brilliantly representing the 5th District of Minnesota. His website, ellison.house.gov. You can tweet him at Keith Ellison, just like it sounds, KEITHELLISON. And we'll be right back with more of Congressman Keith Ellison. And welcome back. Congressman, you're still with us, right?
Right here.
Yeah, okay, great. Omar, watching us on Free Speech TV in Herndon, Virginia. Omar, you are on the air with Congressman Ellison.
Hey, Omar.
Hello,
Hello, Congressman Ellison. Thank you for taking my call. I'm Tom Harmon. And Eid Mubarak to you. Late Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak. Eid Mubarak. Juma Mubarak. Salaam alaikum.
Juma Mubarak. I just wanted to know, Mr. Ellison, what are we doing right now to take back? What's our strategy to take back the House, the Senate, and the White House? And also, I want to know about what is the DNC doing to deal with this voter oppression, like the caging in Ohio, that if you don't vote for 2 years, they're going to write you off. And this voter oppression throughout the country, what are we doing to tackle that?
Let me tell you what we're doing. We are doing what I would call radical presence. We are becoming present and engaged in every single zip code in the United States. We had a program called Resistance Summer this summer, where we literally knocked on thousands and thousands of doors all over the country. The DNC gave every state party extra money for one purpose: canvassing, door to door canvassing, not television, not mail, direct voter engagement. We actually were present and helped folks win in Iowa, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and statewide seats. Now, we're going to continue that program. It's going to morph into the fall. It's called Rise and Organize, but it's canvassing. We have not been doing off-year canvassing. This is new. And we're going in strong in Virginia, but we're not forgetting about every other zip code in America. Our idea is that, you know, people view elections properly. They view them as a means to a better community. But us politicians have viewed election as the be-all and the end-all. If we will engage people all the time around building stronger community, then the election becomes a no-brainer, because it's like, hey, the election is going to help us build a stronger community. Because we've acted like the election is the end, people treat it in a very transactional way and don't really see the whole point, because it's not clear to them how this improves their lives in their community. So that is what we're doing. And so, you know, we've had people on the ground in Michigan and Mississippi. We've had them all over the country. And so that's what we're doing. Now, I don't know if you feel it yet, but we want you to do that. So check us out. We have a weekly program called Democrats Live. It's a live weekly It's a weekly Facebook Live live stream, and we're pushing out information about it all of the time. Now, when it comes to voter protection, we know that the stock and trade of the Republicans is suppressing the vote. There's more of us than there are of them. So what are they going to do? They're going to suppress us. Well, we're fighting back. We're suing. We're challenging everywhere. We have a voter protection program. And, you know, we've been active and on the ground. And we're using litigation, and we're using preparation and advance action. Now, I'm not going to tell you we're where we need to be. We are sure not. Man, we got a whole lot more work to do, but I think that we have a clear direction and plan, and we've made some substantial steps, certainly since, you know, like May, June, to really reorganize the Democratic Party into a grassroots-oriented party from what was, in my opinion, a battleground state party.
Yeah, that is absolutely great. And this thing of vote theft, I don't call it voter suppression, or I do, but...
Yeah, vote theft.
I
like your word better.
Yeah, because it is. It is vote theft. They're stealing our votes from us, damn it. And,
right,
you know, we should have a right to that. Congressman Keith Ellison taking your calls. We'll be back in just a second with more of your calls to Congressman Ellison. Congressman Keith Ellison taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And let's see here. Jack in Sacramento, California. You're on the air with Congressman Ellison.
Yes.
So,
hello.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah, hi, Congressman Ellison. I worked for Bernie there for a couple of years and was very disappointed with the election. I'm looking at John Nichols' article in The Nation, you know, where it talks about the Democratic Party's lurch to the center, not going after rural districts. You know, I appreciate your energy. I'm a strong supporter of you. We're not getting this force. And frankly, this theme, a better deal, is just way too weak. I'm not sure what it should be. It's complicated to get the right message. But we've got to stop going for the center and triangulation. I even understand we're not supporting free choice and abortion anymore. Are we moving to the center? Are we trying to triangulate and have a milquetoast campaign? I don't feel the aggressiveness.
The answer is no, we're not doing that. That is not what we're doing.
But let me just tell you this. The easiest thing to do, and also the most dangerous to do thing to do, is to be cynical, right? We're not giving up. It is an absurd idea that we are backing off our commitment to a woman's right to choose. We absolutely are there. We've been there. And anybody who says that we're not doing that, show me the evidence as to where we've said we were not going to do that. It's just not the case. And I want to assure everybody who's worried about it that we are as for women's rights as we ever have been, if not more. That's where the party is. It's in our platform. That's where it's at. So there's that. We're not going toward the center. In fact, I think that it's clear that every time I go to a rally and I mention the importance of Medicare for all or single payer, that's the applause line. That's what people want. That's where people are going. Elizabeth Warren just signed Bernie's bill. I've been on Bernie's bill for years. And, you know, that's where it's at. So I don't see that the Democratic Party is going toward the center. Now, let me just say this. All parties are coalitions, and all coalitions that come together have different things that they want. So it is true that today the Democratic Party is your progressive, activist like yourself, like myself, like Tom. But there are also people who are a little bit more centrist. They are in our party. They're there. The question is, will we be energetic enough to move the party in the direction we want it to go in? If we check out, for sure the centrists will win. If we engage, well, then maybe they're going to have to see it our way. But my thing is, the moment now calls for engagement. It calls for you to be involved. Now, you said something about you don't like the better deal. Let me tell you, the better deal is a document written to satisfy a broad coalition of people. But the better deal does work for progressives because it calls for what? Increase in minimum wage, increase in overtime pay. It calls for increase in pay and for people. It calls for cutting costs. What costs? Medical treatments, the cost of health care, the cost of college, the cost of rents. But then it talks about how to fight the rigging of the economy, and we deal with monopoly, and we deal with market concentration, and we deal with the money in politics. So there is plenty enough to work with. Let me tell you, there has never been a collection of words arranged in any arrangement that you want that are going to magically get everybody on board and inspire everybody. It's never happened, and it never will. We've got to understand what is messaging. Messaging has to do with the messenger, how that message is delivered. Then it has to do with the words that we say, and then it has to do with doing what we said we were going to do. The days when the Democratic Party can say we're for the working people, but then support trade deals that hurt working people must absolutely come to an end. The days when the Democratic Party says we're for low-cost, unaffordable drugs, and then we don't fight for those things, that has to come to an end. Now, how does it come to an end? People like you demand it. You get up on Tom Hartman's show and you say, we're not putting up with this. You write letters, and you make Democrats be Democrats. Now, that's how we're going to win. But to just say, oh, it's not what I want, so I'm not sure I'm enthusiastic, man, let me tell you where you get your enthusiasm from. When you think about 32 million people having their health care stripped away, if the Republicans would have repealed the Affordable Care Act, that ought to motivate you. When you think about 800,000 kids who are Americans in every way being kicked out of the country by Trump, hopefully that gets you fired up. When you think about the president hugging and acting soft on the KKK, that ought to get you animated. So that's all I got to say, man. Thank you for the call, but I need you to be an activist. And I just want to say this to you. It's so easy to be a critic, but it's hard to actually organize people and make it work. You know, and I know a lot of, I'm not saying this is you, but I know a lot of progressives who would rather intellectualize about message than to get out and knock a door. That's what we need. Go knock a door. Go knock a door. Go call somebody, recruit them to be involved in this movement. That is what I believe we really need.
Yeah, my we just have 40 seconds till that break at the bottom of the hour I was telling you about. My big thing is telling people, join your local Democratic Party. Try to become a precinct committee person.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely, yes.
I mean, you know, stop complaining and become part of the solution, damn it. It's just a very straightforward process. So people can find their local Democratic parties, what, by Googling them, by looking in the phone book?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Heck yeah. I got it. You can... You call up the DNC and say, where's my local party? And let me tell you, man, local parties are jacked, man. They're excited all over the country.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about it when we come back.
It's great. You can stick around for a little bit longer?
Yeah, I'm going to hang out with you.
Super. Okay, we got about a five-minute break here. Congressman Keith Ellison with us taking your calls. We'll be back with more of Congressman Ellison and your calls, your thoughts, and my thoughts and the news of the day. Stick. Fantasy football fans, the wait is nearly over. Football is back, which means FanDuel is back. FanDuel is fantasy football for everyday fans. They have new contests starting every week, so there's no busted seasons. FanDuel has something for everyone. Lots of contests to choose from, starting at just $1. Just pick a contest, choose your team, and watch your score in real time. Hey, would you like to have Colin Kaepernick on your team? He's on mine. There's a lot of ways to put together and personalize your team, and boy, the games just get better and better. Over 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Sign up today. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use my code TOM, T-H-O-M. New users get free entry into the NFL Sunday Million with over $1 million in cash prizes when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. Just visit FanDuel.com and sign up with promo code TOM, T-H-O-M. That's FanDuel, FanDuel.com, promo code TOM, void where prohibited. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Congressman Keith Ellison on the line with us. Congressman, you still here?
I'm with you, man.
Great.
I appreciated you sharing with us that there's more than one way to run an economy.
Yeah, well, thank you.
The only way.
Oh, yeah, that we play that over our stream, that people can hear. A lot of people who are listening to regular radio stations and things don't hear that book report. That was from a book I wrote called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. So ready to pick up some phone calls, and you've got, another 5-10 minutes with us?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Just let me know when you got a bail, okay?
Yeah.
Let's see here. Tim in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind? You're on with Congressman Ellison.
Doing, Congressman Ellison, how you doing, sir?
Great.
Hey, I just had a question. I'm a fourth generation farmer here in the Central Valley, California.
Awesome.
And
thank you for feeding us. We appreciate
what's that?
It. Thank you for feeding us. We appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Well, we've kind of got ran out. We were a small mom and pop, so we went bankrupt in '98. So, but anyway. I dealt with the DACA program. I've got a lot of as a kid, we used to have coyotes bring family members over and work for us. And I have brothers and sisters who came over as illegals who worked their way through the system and got their paperwork and are legal now. They're family members. Those are the people who fought for our land with us, who worked right beside us. It was really a family mentality. And that's what most farm families are. And that's how we see most of the workers coming over. But I also saw in these cities, the corruption that takes place because of the open border and the isolation that a lot of these immigrants are put in by their own people who are held in third world conditions in a first world nation in our country, which isn't acceptable. So somehow, Congressman, I would like that you guys work together to get them out of the shadows. As DACA goes, I'm a Republican. Those kids belong here. They have no other home except here. And you guys need to work together to get them legal and get them done. And I will promise you, if Trump tries to push them out, I will fight with you to keep them here because there is no other place for them. The proper.
But you got my commitment. You got my commitment to help them get a status.
Yeah. Tim, thank you. So you were saying, Congressman.
I think I commend him for calling, and I thank him for his observation. I don't really refer to any human being as an illegal, but I understand what he's trying to say. And so I think he's right. Trump precipitated this. I mean,
You know, and by the way, you know, we've been trying to push for comprehensive immigration reform for years. John Boehner just would never give us a vote. And when Tim Ryan got the job, you know, he promised he wouldn't bring up a vote on an immigration bill. So we'll see if he's going to keep that. I hope he doesn't. That's a promise not worth keeping. But, I mean, I think it's right. I mean, you know, and I'll also say this. In the United States, we cannot keep subsidizing commodities like corn and others, dumping them into Mexico, and then saying, and then running smallholders out of business, and then mad when they come north to work. I mean, people don't want to look. Why would anybody leave their family, leave their culture, leave their loved ones, leave, you know, to come north to get discriminated against? They do it because of necessity, and in part, they do it because of our policy. You know, wages have dropped in Mexico 9% since NAFTA. NAFTA's no picnic for the Mexican people. It might make Carlos Slim a lot of money, but, you know, it doesn't make the average person. So what's my point? We need a comprehensive immigration bill. I'm for it. I'm glad to have some Republicans who believe that. I'm glad to have some Republicans who want to stand with us on DACA. Let's get a vote. Let's vote this. Let's get this thing over. Let's get this thing done right away. I'm ready to vote now.
Okay. Kurt in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Congressman Ellison.
Hey, Mr. Ellison, Congressman Ellison, it is an honor to speak with you, and thank you, Tom, for taking my call so quickly. I live in L.A. County.
Hey.
It is so fortunate that I just got on after this guy just got off the radio. I live in L.A. County, but the way they got these things gerrymandered, Kevin McCarthy's district reaches into L.A. County all the way from Bakersfield.
Right.
And he has ran virtually unopposed since almost 2006.
Unacceptable.
And I would like to run against him. He is my congressman.
Good.
And I have had the FEC website bookmarked and on my webpage, on my browser for over 2 weeks, trying to figure out some of this paperwork. And if I can just get you to respond to some of the emails and tweets that I've sent you to kind of help me get a campaign manager or somebody who can point me in the right direction, I promise you I will not disappoint you or any other person in the Democratic committee, because
let me say this. I'm not aware of any reach outs you've made to me, because if you reached out to me, I'd reach back. But just DM me on Twitter, man. You know, I'm at Keith Ellison, and I'll plug you into the right folks, man. There's a way of doing this. Kevin McCarthy needs to be confronted on the issues, debated, and I think it would be better if he was in the private sector for everybody. And so I'm very encouraged by you running. In fact, if anybody listening to the sound of my voice, I want you to think about running for office, for real, if you're for the people. And so let's get it done, man. DM me, man. I'd love to talk to you about next steps.
Okay. Jordy in Seattle, you're on the air with Congressman Ellison.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've seen a call to be in the streets on November 4th, and I've seen signs from this group, RefuseFascism.org, lately calling for people to be in the streets and continue to be in the streets until the Trump-Pence regime are removed. Do you think that we have a good shot at impeachment, and how much good will it do when there are more Republicans lined up behind them?
I think exercising your First Amendment right to disagree with your government and to redress grievances is always a good idea. So there's that. Do I think that, I don't know if we can impeach him. I put it like this. If we don't try, we won't be able to do it. It's like one of those things where I can't guarantee you we're going to win, but I can say that if we don't play the game, we will for sure lose. That's what I got for you, man. I mean, I'm just not the kind of person to, you know, gas you up and tell you a bunch of things you want to hear. I don't know if we can get him impeached, but guess what? He ought to be impeached. He deserves to be. And I think that we need to support the Mueller investigation. As a matter of fact, Republicans like Congressman DeSantis in Florida are already trying to push bills to limit the investigation. What are they afraid of?
There's already, he's already threatening and publicly trying to undermine the investigation of him. He already fired Comey. So my thing is, let's keep the pressure on.
Yeah, amen. We have just 3 minutes to a break at 45, Congressman. Jennifer in Las Cruces, New Mexico. You're on the air with Congressman Ellison.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. I had, actually, I was trying to embrace free solutions that initiatives that are out there right now. And I was just wondering if you embrace these ideas as well. One of them is the national popular vote, which would circumvent the need for the Electoral College.
I agree.
Well, it would actually wouldn't circumvent it altogether, but it is it would give us a popular vote to select the president. And then the next one would be the ranked choice voting, which could be used as part of a national strategy. And
we're doing ranked choice voting in Minneapolis right now, so I do have experience with it. And I think we're still working the kinks out. It's been positive. It's had some negatives, too. But I think we still got to keep working that over. For those who don't know, you just rank your choices, and you can skip the whole primary. You don't even need a primary. It's like automatic runoff. What's the third one, ma'am?
Oh, her third one was full representation. She's dropped off the line now. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm
not sure exactly what she meant by that.
Yeah, but the first two I am aware of, I'm fully supportive of the first. With the second one, I think it works well at the local level. You know, we can continue to talk about it. So, hey, Tom, unfortunately, I got to hit the door, man. But thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure.
I'll see you next Friday.
Congressman Ellison, thank you so much for being with us. Great talking.
I
truly appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news and information from Wall Street and Main Street, all points in between, plus the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, show up, participate, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.